There's no correlation between the length of a legislative proposal and the amount of debate it generates. Take Senate Joint Resolution 1, which is under consideration this session. It would add two short phrases, just 21 words in all, to Article 1, Section 17 of the Indiana Constitution. Supporters tout the measure as an attempt to protect Hoosiers by allowing judges to deny bail for suspects thought to pose a threat to the public. Opponents say the real threat is the proposal itself, in that it would, they say, erode bedrock civil liberties. Hi, I'm John Schwantes, and we'll dive into the debate on this week's edition of Indiana Lawmakers. From the State House to your house. For now, in keeping with the notion that individuals are presumed innocent until proven guilty, the Indiana Constitution requires courts to set bail for any suspect accused of any offense other than murder or treason, and the state's highest court has ruled that judges can't sidestep that provision by setting excessive bail amounts. Senate Joint Resolution 1 seeks to amend the state constitution to empower judges to keep potentially dangerous suspects behind bars pending trial. Joining me to discuss this issue are Republican Senator Eric Cook of Bedford, author of SJR 1, Senator Rodney Pohl, Jr. of Chesterton, ranking minority member of the Senate Committee on Corrections and Criminal Law, Daviess County Prosecutor Dan Murray, representing the Indiana Prosecuting Attorneys Council, and Bernice Corley, Executive Director of the Indiana Public Defender Council. Thank you all for being here for this important conversation. Senator, you are the author. What's at work here? Why is this something that is so important we need to amend the state's constitution?
Sure. Well, John, first, this is a Senate Majority Caucus agenda bill. This is one of a handful of bills that our caucus has identified as a priority because...
As indicated by the fact that it bears number one.
A little bit of a coincidence. Senate Joint Resolution 1. And this is something that is top of mind among our constituents. And we hear it from our constituents. We hear it from our prosecutors, our judges. All of us have, you know, sadly opened a newspaper or turned on a TV and saw a situation where someone was released on bail and went out and committed a horrible crime. And the public just says, why? How can this happen? So SJR 1 would align Indiana with 22 other states whose constitutions all have similar language. In addition, there's 9 states that don't have any state constitutional right to bail, nor is there one in the federal system. So right now we're kind of an outlier.
They do prohibit excessive bail, most.
Absolutely, which is a different issue. It's a related but different issue. But right now we're kind of an outlier. We're a minority state relative to our sister states. And this is not a red or blue issue. Both, for instance, California and Texas both have similar language, Vermont, Wisconsin. So again, this isn't a Republican or Democrat or a liberal conservative or a red or blue state issue. This is a public safety issue.
And as you pointed out, we're talking about two phrases essentially added, 21 words in all, I counted them up, basically giving judges more latitude to consider the risk.
Risk to the public, and essentially dangerousness.
What's wrong with that? I mean, on the surface, Senator, what's wrong with keeping people safe?
So a couple of things. I can completely appreciate the idea of keeping individuals, keeping communities safe. But we already have that flexibility in the court system with the reform that had recently gone into effect. You're looking at the Constitution, the intent of the framers was, limiting discretion to deny bail to just murder and treason. That was the intent of the Constitution, and now we're essentially expanding that to anybody that would pose or be deemed to pose a substantial risk to the community. It's not defined. So you could have different interpretations through the 600 different judicial officials that make those determinations. That in and of itself, I think, kind of demonstrates that you have the potential of, sure, maybe catching somebody that could be a potential risk, however that's defined. But you also, I think, at a greater risk to deny somebody the ability to defend themselves effectively, support themselves, support their families while they're awaiting trial, because they've been denied bail on this, kind of an undefined determination. And I think that we did try to work to limit that, but unfortunately it didn't pass in the Senate. My hope is that before the end of the legislature, if this, or before the end of the legislative season, before that ends, that there is some work to limit that.
Let me ask you, what would be acceptable? I mean, you're talking about the vagueness here, and in fact, there were even Republican senators, Sue Glick, a former prosecutor who in committee was one of the no votes, and said that it should be void because it is too vague. Well, can it be made more specific to the extent that you're satisfied?
Yeah, like I said, I mean, right now it's murder and treason. The proposal that we had put out there as a caucus from the Democratic side was limit this to serious violent felons. What we're all kind of talking about, the examples that are given are, we don't want dangerous individuals being out on the street pre-trial. We think that they should be treated the same as essentially individuals that have committed the crimes of murder and treason. That's the intent, from Senator Cook and the proponents of this amendment. We look at this as, well, you're talking about serious violent individuals, so limit it to that. The fear that I think we see is that potentially you could have individuals that are deemed a risk simply because of their affiliations. So individuals that, legally own a number of firearms that are NRA members, they could be deemed as having or being a substantial risk because maybe they committed a violent crime but not a serious violent crime. Or they committed an offense and you have a judge that says, well, you have a lot of access to firearms. Or you have members that have been identified, members of the black and brown community that have been identified as potential affiliates of gang associations. And simply just by that, being denied as a substantial risk. We don't know at this point. So.
All right. We've heard from those in the halls of governance and policy. Let's go to the trenches. Dan Murray, you see this every day as a county elected county prosecutor. Are you hamstrung right now by can you point to examples that people have committed crimes in Daviess County because they have been able to get out under the current constitutional provisions?
So I'm reluctant to point to specific examples, but I can say this. Prosecutors in general, we're in favor of giving judges more tools to address the needs of their community. They're independently elected, and this provision would allow them to assess on a case-by-case basis what the best outcome is. And so to Senator Pohl's point, it's not always a violent crime that creates a substantial risk. I can show you a number of crimes, well, not only a serious violent crime, but crimes like stalking can create a substantial risk to an identified individual, and we, for whatever reason, can't put a bond on them that's high enough. And quite frankly, sometimes it's not honest to put a $10 million bond on somebody. They just need an honest hearing that says, hey, look, you're a threat to a certain individual, you should be held until we can resolve your case.
And now some of these individuals, or in many cases, don't have any legal representation at that hearing, right?
So
is that another issue that should be brought to bear here?
Let's be really clear about that. In an initial hearing, most of the time they don't. But at that hearing, at least in Daviess County, they are immediately assigned counsel if necessary. And I am almost immediately in contact with their counsel about their situation. And then we have bond reduction hearings or let-to-bail hearings very quickly so judges can determine.
So at least in Daviess County, if somebody requested a bond reduction hearing, that person would, without question, have legal representation.
Absolutely.
All right, Bernice Corley. The other side of the equation here, the public defenders. What's wrong with this? I'll kind of go back to that initial question. You know, maybe sounds good on paper. Why the concern?
Unnecessary and dangerous. Unnecessary in that in statute, judges are already directed to consider whether a person is likely to fail to appear and whether that person is a risk to the public in terms of dangerousness. So judges already have that in statute. Dangerous in that the state of Indiana for over a decade has been working to take arbitrariness out of decisions. So whether you're black, brown, person out of national origin outside of this country, we're taking bias out of it through the Criminal Rule 26 process so that judges are making decisions based on data and bias being removed. This language literally inserts bias opportunity such that whether it's just bias or a personality or a family beef that has gone on in counties for a while, a person is vulnerable to losing their freedom pretrial. And then just to tack on to what you said about initial hearing, we do not have a public defender system, an appointment of counsel system that truly will protect a presumed innocent person. To your point, if a person is deemed to be held under this language, in many counties, and I appreciate what Dan said about Davies, but a lot of counties are not in that situation. Statute does not require counsel to be present at the initial hearing. He's right, they get appointed counsel at that initial hearing, but that person is not there. In some counties, it can take a week or more before you get a bond review hearing. So what's happened in that week? You perhaps lost your job, custody of your children, all of this while you're presumed innocent. It's disturbing.
And just so we, for those not familiar with Criminal Rule 26, we should point out this was the Indiana Supreme Court, after, 4 years of pilot studies and analyses, was an attempt, I think, in 2020 to encourage, actually, and bring alignment or some standards, I guess, to pretrial release, and, in fact, encourage pretrial release in many instances. Okay, so you've heard the other side here. Let's take them one at a time. What about the notion that people who are held even for short periods of time are more likely to commit crimes down the line? And we can point to any number of studies that that point to that. Even something as brief as a 24-hour, 36-hour incarceration pretrial can cause problems. I presume that's not because they're being exposed to hardened criminals as much as it is they're perhaps losing jobs, they're perhaps missing payment on their apartment, they're perhaps not able to care for their children, et cetera, et cetera. Is that a compelling argument?
Well, that's the case in many circumstances now. I mean, in the domestic violence sphere, we've got an 8-hour hold in statute. Senator Kreider, one of my colleagues, has a bill that would raise that to 24 hours. This would be an additional tool that, if the circumstances and facts warranted, would let a judge deny bail to someone who's just at a high risk of stalking or killing someone.
So the fact that they may be knocked out of their apartment or anger somebody who has co-custody of a child
that's the case today with most people who are arrested. That wouldn't be a new concern, but I do want to say something about Criminal Rule 26, and it has brought some objectivity. But that assessment tool is not designed to ascertain and measure risk to the community. That's for the purpose of appearance and measuring flight risk. So while it's relevant and it could develop some facts, it could be helpful to a judge under this new language, that's not its purpose.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but before 1996 in Indiana, flight risk was the only consideration. I mean, there was no other factor that could be brought to bear. I think it was legislation enacted in that year that actually started us down this path. Are you suggesting that we're better off now than we were before 1996? I mean, we didn't hear a call for these kinds of reforms throughout the 20th century.
Are you talking about bail reforms?
Yeah,
because
up until 1996, am I right? The only thing you could consider if you were a judge other than murder and treason was a flight risk issue.
Well, and in the context of today's discussion, which is safety to the community, under our current constitution, you couldn't consider that in 1996 either.
So, right, right.
So kind of fast forward to today.
And that was a flaw then, and you'd say it's a flaw now.
I wouldn't call it a flaw. We amend our constitution from time to time. And it's not an easy thing to do, and it shouldn't be an easy thing to do, right? It takes the affirmative vote of two consecutively elected General Assemblies, and then the people vote
on
it.
So not just next session, it has to be the session after that,
and then the most important step of all is the people of Indiana,
having
2026 at the earliest, that general election. We've amended the Constitution recently to require a balanced budget. We've amended our Constitution to create a constitutional right to hunt and fish, one of Senator Steele's initiatives. We've amended our Constitution to cap property taxes. So it's a difficult process. It should be difficult, but it's something that we do from time to time.
Give me the most compelling argument against this. Is it the notion that people can lose jobs, can run into difficulty with custodianship of their children, Or is it the racial component? There are other data that show nationally, I haven't seen data for the state of Indiana, but that African Americans, bail is generally set a significant amount yep. higher, and in Latino population same. I mean, what of all these sorts of, in your arsenal of complaints or concerns, do you see as the most compelling?
Well, I think you just kind of said there is no data to demonstrate that this will effectively or ensure that we are going to keep the community safe, or safer than what we have now, the tools that we have now. I think there's a Supreme Court decision that recently came out that demonstrated that an individual, a teenage girl that had been an accessory, I believe. I'm looking to Bernice because I know she's pretty well versed on this.
She was driving the car, alleged getaway car, I guess is what you.
So yeah, she was, and ultimately.
So you can look to me too.
Yeah. But you had bail that was set at $50,000 in that situation, and that's effectively a no bail.
Of course, it was okay though.
And that's exactly it. I mean, I think the system that we have in place now does provide for the ability for courts to already assess, essentially assess what is, the proper bail for an individual, and if that is unattainable for an individual, that is essentially, effectively keeping that person out. And so, I mean, we already have that. We already have the discretion that's there. I think that this is going to you're going to catch more people that are, that should have absolutely, should absolutely enjoy the presumption of innocence. I think what essentially this is doing is kind of flipping the script on those individuals, people that find themselves on the other side of the law. You have a burden of proof that is beyond the preponderance of the evidence to demonstrate once a compelling argument has been made that, your affiliations, your background, maybe some of the facts of that. And I think one thing that we can't ignore is, these, and a lot of times there's elected officials, elected judges that are making these determinations, and you may have high profile cases where there is going to be, I think, some more pressure to from both the community, from victims, family members of victims, to ensure that, oh, well, we don't want that person to get out.
So, let me ask somebody who also owes his current job to voters, and that would be the county prosecutor. How about this argument that judges need to be seen as tough on crime, that you need to be seen as prosecutor as tough on crime, and that heaven forbid somebody who is released on bail goes out and commits a crime, that there's that tendency to want to err on the side of caution, which may mean locking people up unnecessarily?
A couple things. One is I trust judges to make the right decision. Two, prosecutors are in an adversarial position here. We would have to prove this up. And I mean, we can argue over preponderance of the evidence or any other higher standard, but it is still our burden to show. By and large, and I really do believe judges make the correct decision on the evidence. But let's take the specific example of the woman who couldn't post $50,000. As a prosecutor, I like transparency. Let's be honest. That person should be held because of future dangerousness if that's what the judge decides, not because she can't post bond. I'm against having wealthy people be in a better position having committed the same crime, and they could post the bond. Let's just make it not about the money on the high end and say if you pose a threat to the community, a substantial threat, you should be held. The prosecutor's shown that. We'll see how it goes from there. The idea that bond on the high end is sufficient doesn't always capture the whole truth. So that's why we feel like we're in a position to give tools to judges and transparency to the community. Quite frankly, if I went to the coffee shop in my hometown and talked to my buddies John and Joe and Mark, and I told them that substantial risk wasn't what judges consider right now, they'd be stunned. They would be like, well, what are we talking about when we set bond? So it's one of the things that we would love to see what the people have to say on this, just as Senator Cook outlined.
Respond to this. I mean, again, is it the notion, I mean, it sounds as if there is some concern even on your part about a two-tier in terms of socioeconomics, then you'd say you'd like to find ways to work around that. Is that the issue? Is it this discretion? Is it race? Again, the data show that for whatever reason, bails have been nationally are set higher. And again, which of these is the one that you would put your money on in terms of if this, you're trying to make your argument to Hoosiers, which eventually, presumably you will, by 2026, what are you going to be telling them?
Yeah. Well, what I'll tell them is we do have a problem with bail in Indiana. And the problem is that, as Dan sort of alluded to, there's the other end of the spectrum. There are poor people who are not violent, not dangerous, who are held in jail on a very low amount of bail, $1,000 or less. There are people all over Indiana. Jails all over Indiana are stuffed with people who are poor, often who are also poor and a minority or a not majority person in Indiana. That is not being addressed here. Instead, what we're adding is another layer to detain people who are presumed innocent. And it's not right. It's not right to use our public resources, our wealth, our tax dollars that are supposed to be for all of our good to go largely to incarcerating people that there is no evidence are more dangerous than anybody else. I mean, it's hard to just narrow it down to one. It's quite dangerous, and we are not addressing our real problem. And we are hurting our Hoosiers. We are hurting people by needless incarceration and use of these coercive tools.
You know, as we look at trends, and you talked about the states that are already have this approach, but other states, and perhaps this predates the pandemic, which threw a curveball to a lot of us in terms of public policy, but there were states that were moving toward eliminating cash bail and saying essentially, New Jersey, for instance, if it's a nonviolent offense, you get a summons. And if it's violent, I guess you'd get you're held 48 hours. And they saw a 35% reduction in their jail population. It seemed to work out well. There was no real spike. Again, the data, I guess you could say, aren't ripe yet because these are relatively recent changes. Other states, New Mexico, I think some others have done this. What do they have? Are they off base in their approach to try to take that different strategy?
Well, I'm personally not a supporter of no cash bail. I think it's a little early to draw any conclusions about some of these other states. We have to be really careful. That's a different issue than the one before us today, is what is our obligation as leaders to our communities? What is their expectation of us? And, you know, when you step back and think about what was the original reason that men and women formed governments, and that was for their safety, for public. That is the fundamental purpose of government. And in my mind, this bill, the Senate Joint Resolution, fulfills that purpose.
Would you like to? Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say. I mean, I'm glad that Senator Cook brought that up. He's talking about the original purpose of government in general. The original purpose of bail was to ensure that you showed up for court. And this kind of throws that out the window and says, well, no, we don't really care whether or not you show up for court. We're going to make sure you show up for court, regardless of whether or not you have been determined by a group of your peers to be guilty or not. And I think that really turns it, and I'm really glad that you brought up these other states that do have, no cash bail. I'm not saying that that's necessarily where we're going with this, but ultimately, when you see the data in some of those states where you don't see a spike in violent crime, you do see a reduction in jail population, something that we talked about last year ad nauseum in some of the reforms to essentially our jails are getting so packed right now, we're trying to ship them back, ship low-level offenders to DOC, which again goes against what we just
part
did.
Where they could get treatment for mental health issues or addiction, that's been an issue certainly in recent years.
So I think what you're ultimately going to see is even more crowded jails, more funds that we're going to have to expend as a state at the local level and at DOC, which I know they're concerned about, the shift that's coming. So I think we're really tinkering, in changing our entire constitution and flipping the script on accused individuals. And I don't think that, I don't think it's the right decision at this point.
And Dan Murray, do we know enough in this debate? Right now, the for-profit bail industry essentially is under no obligation to release any data about who shows up, who doesn't, et cetera, et cetera. There we have some nonprofits that have tried to gather some of that information. Do we need more? Are we starved for data before we can make these decisions properly?
I love data, but I love solving problems even more. And the way this constitutional amendment has been written, it's just a problem-solving tool. That's it. It's for I don't deal with cash bail bonds in my small county, so I couldn't answer that. But to Bernice's point, there's always room to improve as prosecutors. I don't claim otherwise. I know what I do with low-level offenders, and I try to get them out, and I'm a big fan of not having too many contacts with the criminal justice system. But our main concern still focuses on the bigger picture, which is the most dangerous among us.
Bernice, you get the last word. We could talk a lot more with time, unfortunately. We have early release for all of you, I guess, is what this this means. This debate we talked about, it wages over this session, perhaps not next session, but the one subsequent to that, and then voters. Where does this battle, in your mind, strategically and tactically need to be waged? Because once it gets to voters, we've seen what the wording is in other states, and it's like, should judges get to worry about your safety more or less? So that is this battle, from your perspective, does it need to be waged and won in the General Assembly?
At this point, that's where we are, and it has to be, and I hope a fuller discussion happens. I hope that we begin, if we're going to enshrine detention in our constitutions, we need to enshrine presumptive release for low-level, low-risk people.
Well, at least we've started that discussion, certainly, or added to the discussion, and I thank you all for being part of this. We'll be watching this session and beyond. Again, my guests have been Republican Senator Eric Cook of Bedford, Senator Rodney Pohl, Jr. of Chesterton, Daviess County Prosecutor Dan Murray, and Bernice Corley, Executive Director of the Indiana Public Defender Council. And time now for our weekly conversation with Indiana lawmakers commentator Ed Feigenbaum, publisher of the newsletter Indiana Legislative Insight, part of Hanna News Service. Ed, we covered a lot of territory about the sort of the substance and the arguments for and against. Let's talk process. I know you're a process guy. What happens here? It's moved out of committee on a 5-3 vote. Now what?
Now it goes to the floor, obviously, but when we're talking about a constitutional amendment, John, this has to pass in two successive sessions of the General Assembly. So that means that the group of lawmakers that's elected next time around also gets to vote on this. So whatever happens this year, if it does pass this year, that's not the end of things. And if it passes in the two successive sessions, then it goes on to the ballot for the 2026 election, and the people will get to vote on it. And that's where it gets even more interesting. You know, you might think that, oh, yeah, it's a slam dunk. People will say, yeah, we've got to pass this thing. But what we may see in Indiana by 2026 is the same kind of phenomenon that we're seeing nationally on other issues. And that's, you've got these third-party interest groups, these special interest groups that have, some particular bent on a given issue, come in on either side of this and say, hey, we're going to spend however many millions of dollars to capture the hearts and minds of Hoosier voters. And you may have some interesting kinds of arguments raised that may twist the debate. So you just don't know what's going to happen when it does go to the voters.
And a lot of attention will be paid to the wording of the question that's put before voters, too, because that could make or break probably the way this we've seen that.
Absolutely.
Around the country.
And the question that you posed to Bernice Corley was absolutely apropos toward the end of the roundtable, and that's, hey, is this where you really need to kill it? Because otherwise it's going to end up going to the voters.
So let me ask you a version of what I asked her. And you're right, things could happen. Third parties could come in 2026 if it does go to voters. And how likely this session? Again, 5-3 vote out of committee, wasn't entirely party line, but what do you see happening as it moves through the chambers this session?
Gee, there you go, talking substance again with process. And we saw a really great debate in the committee that Senator Cook led on this one, some of the same players that we had around the table today. And you saw a great discussion today. And there's a big difference between some of the substantive things that they got into in committee and in the roundtable today and what you're going to see on the floor of the House and the Senate. That gets a little bit more raucous and a little bit more of the kind of populist theme component to it, and things can be very different on the floor than in committee on this one.
Very good. Well, we will be watching. As always, Ed, thank you for your insight. This is the final budget session for second-term governor Eric Holcomb. Will lawmakers look favorably on his priorities? The governor joins us on the next Indiana Lawmakers. Well, that concludes another edition of Indiana Lawmakers. I'm John Schwannis, and on behalf of commentator Ed Feigenbaum, WFYI Public Media, and Indiana's other public broadcasting stations, I thank you for joining us, and I invite you to visit WFYI.org for more Statehouse news. Until next week, take care.